It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A study published in the Journal of School Health finds media literacy is more effective in preventing teens from smoking than traditional anti-smoking efforts. Joining us to discuss the study and its findings is its lead author, Dr. Brian Primack, Associate Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics and Director of the Program for Research on Media and Health at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Primack, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. How old were you when you started smoking? Have you quit? And what convinced you to do so? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Dr. Primack, how did this study work?
Well, what we did was to actually recruit three different high schools and 64 different classrooms. They were randomized to receive either the traditional anti-smoking program or the media literacy program. So it's the first time that we really brought the rigor of a randomized controlled trial to this particular area.
And what is the traditional anti-smoking program? I think some of us may remember it from school, but refresh our memory.
Sure. Traditional programming emphasizes effects on the body. It emphasizes things like how to resist peer influence for starting smoking and that type of thing. Media literacy is a different kind of approach that really emphasizes teaching young people and empowering them to analyze and evaluate all of the different media-related smoking messages that they are going to be exposed to.
And explain how this particular approach empowers participants. What tools are they given that enables them to analyze and evaluate portrayals of tobacco use in the media that sometimes glamorize smoking?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And you know, let me give you an illustration. You might have two different young people, both very similar in terms of socioeconomic background, in terms of intelligence, in terms of experience, and whether their parents smoke and that type of thing. However, one of the people, you know, sees an image of smoking in a popular movie, and it simply washes over them, maybe goes into their conscious and or subconscious, and makes them more likely to think that smoking, as you said, is glamorous, is empowering, is exciting, and something that they might want to do. The other young person in this scenario has in the past had, you know, specific types of education, media literacy education, and they have actually seen the documents that Sylvester Stallone signed in the 1980s where he agreed to smoke in five different movies in exchange for $500,000. And so that kid, when they see that episode of smoking, they're much more likely, perhaps, to take a second look and to say, geez, I wonder if this actor was influenced. I wonder if the director or the screenwriter or the producer was influenced. And they may not take that message at face value like the other person. And we're finding that that more media literate person turns out to be much less likely to ultimately become a smoker and become addicted to cigarettes.
Why is smoking as popular as it is among young people and teenagers? You mentioned some of the influences here, and everybody sees them. But teenagers, young people in particular, sometimes seem to be the ideal prey. And clearly, the evidence shows that the advertisers are aiming for this particular demographic, are they not?
Absolutely they are. And it's a very good question because it's surprising to realize that 50 years after the Surgeon General's landmark report, smoking is still the number one cause of preventable death in the United States. Over 450,000 deaths a year. Now, we certainly have put a lot of effort into this, and certainly there have been a lot of strides made. And the biggest ones are things that are, you know, generally policy related, clean air laws, some of the major media campaigns like the Florida Truth campaign had, some effect. But a lot of the education in schools, just hasn't been as effective as we would like. And that's why we're really targeting, you know, this particular area. You would think that it's a really ripe population. You know, they're captive. They're there ready to listen. But a lot of the traditional programming, kids tend to rebel against it. Especially if they are the traditional rebellious, sensation-seeking type young person who is more likely to become a smoker.
Is a lot of the approach that needs to be taken here, does it need to be about this is less about this is bad for you, this is not good for your health, and maybe more about something related to the image of smoking that – hey, you know what? This really isn't cool. Does that, you have to approach it from that kind of psychological standpoint?
Absolutely. And I think that there is an element of that in media literacy. I think it does go even a step further, though, in saying, you know, where does this image come from? How was this image created? Mm-hmm. Who is the head of this company that created this image? And how much money do they make every year? And what specific things did they do to create this? How many psychologists did they hire to create this image?
Give me an example, like an image of, say, the Camel and the Camel cigarette seems to be something that the tests have shown that that for whatever reason, young people think, oh yeah, this character, I can identify for whatever reason with this makes it fun and cool.
Absolutely. And Camel is a perfect example. 20 years ago now, there was a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that showed that six-year-olds were more likely to recognize Joe Camel than Mickey Mouse at that point.
Yikes.
So clearly, you know, they, you know, very specifically took this image. They created a cartoon because they knew that that was the right image for the market they were looking at. Now, you might say, well, that's crazy. You know, they're not really going after young people. However, when we actually analyze tobacco industry documents, they say, quote, we examine young people as young as 5 years old to see what they are interested in. So clearly they're not expecting that 5 year old is going to go out and buy a case, but they're starting to get them interested. They're starting to get that image that we have been talking about primed.
So is part of the media literacy then to instill in a teenager the idea that, you know, there are forces at work that are trying to manipulate you, and you're going to end up perhaps getting played if you buy into it?
Exactly. And the reason why that is potentially very powerful is because, you know, that word you use, manipulation, no one likes to be manipulated, but especially a teenager. And especially a rebellious, sensation-seeking teenager. So that's why a lot of the traditional programming, you know, may be effective for people who aren't as likely to smoke in the first place. But what we need to do is create programming that's really good for those people who don't like to be manipulated and who are more likely to be at risk.
We're talking with Dr. Brian Primack. He's Associate Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics and Director of the Program for Research on Media and Health at the University of Pittsburgh. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a comment or question for him, 412-246-2002 is the number to call, 412-246-2002. We'd like to hear how you ended up starting smoking, what convinced you to start or stop, and if you've never smoked, what was it about the smoking prevention programs when you were growing up that kept you from smoking? 412-246-2002, the number to call to take part in the conversation. Since cigarette ads are banned on television and radio, and they have been for over four decades, how is it that youth ages, you mentioned ages as young as five, but the general range is 8 to 18. As you point out in your study, they continue to be exposed to more than 10 hours of media content each day, including multiple positive images of smoking. Where is this? Where are all these images coming? 10 hours a day?
It is extremely surprising, and I really do urge listeners to look up the Kaiser Family Foundation's report on media exposure among 8 to 18-year-olds because 10 hours, it was actually 10.5 hours was total exposure per day. A lot of that, and you think to yourself, do teenagers even have this amount of time? Because that didn't include school time. It didn't include, you know, watching a part of a TV show while you're in class or being on the internet at school. A lot of that is because of weekends when young people are plugged in for maybe 16, 17 hours a day. The thing, though, that I find even more surprising.
Okay, but where's it coming from?
Well, for example, in that report, you'll see everything broken down, and people are exposed to 4.5 hours at this age of television content per day. A lot of people say, well, television, isn't that completely gone?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not. In fact, people are watching television content more than ever. They're watching it at different times. You know, they're not exposed to it at prime time as much as before, but they're watching it on Hulu the next day. They're watching it on their iPhones, and they're still exposed to those 4.5 hours. Then there's over 2.5 hours of music exposure each day. There's movies, there's internet, and so when you add all of this up, and
there's still that much smoking that goes on in these types of media entities,
right? So that's a very, very good question.
Because years ago, I mean, you couldn't turn on. I mean, even on the talk shows, they were sitting there smoking, and on the Tonight Show, I mean, you know, you'd see the host would have a cigarette in their hand, or the guest would, and it was in movies and it was in television shows. It's not there as much, is it?
Well, it depends on what you define as there and what you define is as much. So, what is fascinating about the industry is mm-hmm. just how able it is to be resilient. So, for example, in 1971, on January 1st, they took all smoking ads off of television. And a lot of people said, oh my goodness, this is it. You know, this is a real blow to the industry. They're going to have difficulty. But then immediately they started paying stars like Sylvester Stallone to smoke and actually got their message out more. Another example is the Master Settlement Agreement of 1998 when they said you can't put billboards up anymore. And all of a sudden, you know, a lot of people were saying, again, a big blow to the industry. This is really going to kill their ability to advertise. But now what they do is they just use point-of-sale advertisements that cost them less and that they're able to better target. So you and I may not see as much smoking in exactly the same places as we did before. However, they're getting more targeted. They're getting more specific, and it's actually in many ways more cost-effective for them.
412-246-2002, the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation with Dr. Primack. And we have Mike in Monroeville. Mike, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Well, I'm listening, driving in my car, and there are certain ad campaigns that should have never been permitted, such as Benson Hedges' You Come a Long Way, Baby.
That goes way back.
100s, yeah, 100, so that you smoke a longer cigarette, and then... I remember in the 50s, Kent's with the Micronite filter. But even before that, you had the dancing cigarette packs. And yet these, I assume, were beautiful women with long legs dancing with cigarette cartons on them.
Right. The history of the glamorization of smoking goes way, way back. So your point or your question, Mike, is what?
Well, when they had the heads of the cigarette manufacturers before Congress, and they all lied, that should have been the time for legislation to put cigarettes under the FDA, controlling the amount of nicotine. Okay, I'll get off and listen.
All right, Mike. Well, what about his point? Should, when deceptive tactics were exposed, should the government, the FDA, whomever, have stepped in and really clamped down on the availability, if not the regulation of cigarettes?
Well, it's a very apropos question because now the FDA has stepped in and the FDA is now controlling cigarettes. And this has been over the past couple years, and there have been a lot of important changes that have come along with that. But I think the caller's point that these tactics, you know, have been going on for a long time also points, again, you know, back to the topic that we originally started with, media literacy, that it's also important for us to really teach these things to young people and to have them understand that they are the targets of these campaigns.
412-246-2002, and also you can reach us on Twitter. And David on Twitter says, Americans seem to smoke less than other countries. Is that true?
Well, it depends on which country. Yes and no.
Let's say Europe, for example.
Well, yes, we do smoke a little bit less than Europe. However, our rate our decline is slower than Europe. In other words, Europe is declining more quickly. The other thing that's really important is looking at developing countries: China, India, Russia, Brazil. The rates there are in many cases increasing, which, you know, I mentioned that 450,000 people a year die in the United States. The worldwide number is around 5 million and actually is expected to increase to around 10 million over the next decade or two.
Let's go to Chris in Pittsburgh. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm well. I just I had thought about the fact that I started smoking in middle school because it looked cool. And it was something, you know, kind of a way to sneak away and be with your friends and do something social. And then once I grew up, I realized that this is extremely detrimental to my health, but it was extremely hard to stop doing. I read a book that was recommended to me called The Easy Way to Quit Smoking, and it was pretty much an anti-brainwash, if you will. It allowed you to smoke while you read the book, and it gave you insight as to why you don't need to smoke, such as smokers deal with stress by going out and smoking a cigarette. Well, in everyday life, there are plenty of non-smokers that deal with stress, and they don't have to use the cigarette to do that. So I found that an extremely beneficial way to quit smoking, and I haven't smoked for about 2 years now. I just maybe thought that would be a good point for some smokers listening.
Well, that's a very interesting story that you're sharing, Chris.
It is an interesting story. And Chris, I know the book, and a few of my patients have reported exactly the same type of thing. And, you know, what we're trying to do with media literacy is much more in terms of prevention rather than cessation. But I think that in terms of cessation, the kinds of techniques you're describing definitely have a place. And I appreciate you bringing that up.
Oh, thank you. It was nice to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for the call. Let's go to George in Cranberry. George, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hello, George. Are you there?
You hear me?
Yes. Come in, Cranberry. How are you?
Okay. I was a smoker for 30 years, too. I started when I was 14. And it seems to me what the professor's talking about is quite admirable and should be done. But the real problem is that we allow that industry to exist. We allow tobacco to be farmed, and we allow tobacco companies to promote their product. It should be shut down. We don't allow heroin production. We don't allow cocaine production. And tobacco is just as poisonous and addictive. And it's the power of money. And it's just disappointing that our country is so in the hands of greed, basically.
Well, you may certainly make a point that I think a number of people would agree with, and Dr. Primack being one of them, you are probably preaching to the choir here, George, although your point is well taken, certainly.
Yeah, no, I agree, George. It's kind of interesting to think if all of a sudden tomorrow we discovered that the chalk that we use in schools, caused 450,000 deaths per year in the United States alone, chalk would be gone. Right? So this is an industry that has, many other political and economic factors going on. And I think we can agree that, it's a bit of a puzzle, that it continues to be marketed and continues to be thriving the way it is.
You had a significant number of students who reported at the start of the program that they intended to smoke in the future. Then, among these individuals, 24% of those assigned to the media literacy group reverted to not intending to smoke after the intervention. What changed their minds?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that really was the major finding of the study. Because as I said it before, what we're really interested in are the people who are most at risk, the people who at baseline are most, saying, yes, I am planning on smoking. And so, yes, you're correct. It was about 24 – or it was exactly 24% of them that were assigned to the media literacy group decided not to smoke. And in the other group, it was 16%. So, the traditional program was also somewhat effective, but the media literacy group was more effective. And, we didn't specifically ask them – qualitatively. We didn't interview every single kid about that, you know, but I would presume that it had more to do with, you know, the issues we've been talking about, the desire not to be manipulated, the understanding of what's behind it. Now, you know, but I'd also like to point out that the traditional program is also effective. We used a real and intense traditional program. We didn't use some kind of a, you know, fly-by-night thing that we weren't really trying to have effective, because we wanted to do good research to finally compare these two things head-to-head.
Well, and those – the you know, going back to when I was in high school, which was unfortunately some time ago, I remember the films that they would show that you know, with animation that would, you know, show you what was happening in your lungs. And I mean, that was enough to scare a lot of us off of cigarettes. So not all of that was necessarily ineffective.
Exactly. And, you know, in the future, I think that we will be developing a lot of programming that is somewhat hybrid, you know, that saves some of the potentially positive things that the traditional anti-smoking programs have, but also leverages the benefits of media literacy, you know, that we've been noting.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you, how much are electronic cigarettes complicating this issue, especially when we are led to believe in many cases that these are not like cigarettes at all? They just look like a cigarette.
Exactly. And this is a very good question, and it is one that we actually did not tackle in this particular study, because it is a very hairy, thorny issue. And then another related issue is that of hookah smoking, which has become very popular as well. And I agree, it is a very challenging area and something we need to look into. Throughout history, there have been different types of harm reduction products. You know, you may remember low-tar cigarettes, and a lot of people said at that time, oh my gosh, if we convert everyone to low-tar cigarettes, we're going to get rid of 90% of smoking-related disease. Well, that obviously did not pan out. It actually turned out they were no better. In the case of electronic cigarettes, there certainly are public health people who say, you know, geez, we could use these potentially positively. If we could convert all smokers to electronic cigarettes, you know, in theory, then, you know, we could eliminate a lot of smoking-related disease. They'd still be getting nicotine, but they wouldn't be getting a lot of the other toxic chemicals down into their body. However, there is also a large group of public health people who say, wait a second, this simply is not really feasible to just switch these people. And in fact, these may actually provide a gateway. We may have some young people who reject cigarettes and say, you know, oh, I'm not going to smoke cigarettes. That's really yucky. But these electronic cigarettes, they're safe, they're flavored, you know, they're cool. I'm going to try one of these. And the next thing you know it, they've actually been sensitized to nicotine, because they do contain nicotine, and they've transitioned to regular cigarettes. So even though the jury is still out and we still need to do a lot of studies about these transitions and these different behaviors, I'm glad you brought up that important issue.
Dr. Brian Primack, Associate Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics and Director of the Program for Research on Media and Health at the University of Pittsburgh, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Paul. I had a great time.
Coming up, with many neighborhoods experiencing a development renaissance, we'll look at how to keep housing affordable in low-income areas. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.